The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, rising star Mo Dunford dropped into us at the Cliff House Hotel to talk about films with a purpose, camping with his son, and his somewhat ignoble exit from Vikings. After 127 years, the Dublin fruit and veg market, as you know it, is no more. Today, it will close for renovation and reopen brighter, shinier, and unrecognisable from the Victorian building there today. There have been three generations of Joseph Duffy's selling flowers there, and the current Joseph spoke to me about the end of an era. Alex Barkley's new book is called I Confess. She joined us in studio and told us all about her move to a beautiful corner of Ireland, small town living, and getting inside the mind of a killer. From his first incarnation as a silly, fun-loving priest, he's gone on to much more serious TV roles, but all the while, the comedy keeps calling. Ard Lohanlon was in studio to talk about his first stand-up tour in 5 years called The Showing Off Must Go On. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until the next time, thanks for listening. Now, great Irish actor, Mo Dunford. His career has gone from strength to strength. He's been in Vikings, Patrick's Day, Michael Inside, Black 47, Rosie, all films I've seen and things I'm dying to talk to him about. He's travelled long and far to join us today, all the way from Dungarvan. Mo Dunford, everybody!
How you doing? Welcome to Waterford, Ryan.
Great stuff, Mo.
How was your trip down from Skull?
Was it good?
It was
actually really gorgeous. And, yeah, you know, it's just so nice to get out of RTE and,
sure,
and Dublin and
beautiful
just to
people
see
down
them
there.
Really, all around. So, Mo, we've met a few times down through the years, mostly on shows like this or the TV or whatever.
Yes.
And your career is, I'm watching you from the distance and watching your career blossom. And you're just one of the good guys. So I'm delighted you joined us from here. Before we talk about all of that, let's get your Waterford credentials down. Bring them onto the table now. Let's make sure we have a real son of Waterford here with us today. So tell us a bit about that background.
Yeah, well, I'm from here. I've been living here all my life, as many people I know in the audience there.
Really?
My mom and dad are from here. They were born here. My grandparents are from here. And just generous, genuine people from Dungarvan. You know, I love the place. It's one of the most beautiful towns I can imagine being from. I wouldn't want to be from anywhere else. They're very supportive. And, you know, over the 20, 30 years, you could kind of feel that they got through a lot of hard times economically. You can just feel these days that, you know, they've got through it. There's a lot of joy. It's great to see.
That's great to see. Well, that's it. We believe you, which is the most important. But when you come home then, because you'd be filming in the States and the UK and beyond, you know, into Dublin, Wicklow, wherever, do you love to get back?
Yeah,
here.
Always. I'm always drawn back. Yeah, always. I was only camping this time last week in Ardmore with my son.
How did that go?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, there was glamping pods up in Ardmore, Ardmore Petting Zoo. We did all the coast. We went up to Dunmore East, Dunmore Adventure, Ardmore Adventure, surfing in Tremorts.
And how old is your son?
He's nine.
Nine. You see, when we were in school yesterday, I kept meeting people who were kind of same age as you with their sons and daughters or whatever, all saying, we want to give our kids what we had in terms of summer holidays and, you know, memories and Irish sort of, you know, cold freezing, sandy sandwiches. But yet...
Yeah, well, it's so easy these days to be caught up with video games and with social media. And he's at the age, it's beautiful that Waterford is able to give him the best of their amenities. Like when he jumps into the water, he's the happiest kid ever. It's beautiful to see.
It's a lovely thing to see. Now, let's talk a bit about a few things. One, I'm going to tiptoe through some questions I have for you. Vikings, right?
Yes.
You did 4 years on Vikings?
I did, yeah.
And how do you characterise your experience on that?
Joyous.
Really?
Yeah.
Good crew, good cast, good friends.
Fantastic crew. I made a lot of good friends there. Learned a lot. It grew over time, you know. A lot of hard-working crew, but the show was going out to millions of people, so it was good to be part of such a big show.
And again, great to have it in Ireland, you know, that for the industry, for all, you know, from crew from all levels and acting, and you know,
it was also nice to be part of a show where there's connections to Waterford, you know, the Viking Triangle, and Waterford was the first town where they approached, and being part of a show that has its roots in Irish history as well was great.
Yeah. Well, lovely thing. And there's lots of things you've done have history attached to them. We'll get there in a second. But I do want to ask you a kind of slightly peculiar twist in the tale for how the Vikings ended for you, right?
Here we go.
And this could be a spoiler. If you are watching Vikings, you know what happened to Mo. You're right. Probably going to have to disappear for a few minutes. Because otherwise, we're going to just do it. How do they come and tell you, listen, Mo, this is the end of the road for your character?
Yeah, yeah.
How does that work, that approach?
Well, you know, when I last met you, I was excited because you asked me, I believe you're in Vikings. Well, yeah. I said, yes, I'm really excited to do the action scenes, you know. Little did I know, 4 or 5 years later, they'd be killing me off in the most Nancy-est way.
Don't tell them yet how they killed you off.
But so Morgan O'Sullivan, who's the producer, and Keith Thompson, they have a way of approaching cast members and telling them how they're going to get killed off. And normally it's by beheading or a poison arrow.
It's Vikings, remember,
it's
of course.
Vikings. Yes, yeah. And to me, they said, well, Mo, we're very happy with your time here. You've, you know, given fantastic whatever. And you actually die of a bee sting. And I misheard him. I thought he said basting.
Like getting the head punched off you or something.
Or, getting, you know, dipped in.
Yeah,
whatever.
Oil or
hot oil.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a bee sting. He died. He went into anaphylactic shock.
And when they clarified for you the fact you're going to be killed by a bee, do you have any comeback on that? Could you not think of a bigger animal?
I thought I misheard them because I thought it was a joke. But Michael Hurst, the writer, he wanted to kill him in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
There weren't any Vikings around in England at the time in those episodes. My contract had expired. So I had to make it work, you know. And that's the challenge. I've been asked to do some funny things as an actor, and
sure
the challenge is to make it work. How do you make that work?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I saw an episode of Bear Grylls once where he got stung by a bee. So.
There's your research.
Yeah.
Done and dusted.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about some of the ones that first came to my attention with Patrick's Day. Which was just a terrific look at the disintegration of a young man through...
You gave us tremendous support as well when it came out. Yeah.
Only because of the quality of what you did and as a filmmaking team. And it also was hitting the money in terms of the conversations about mental health were going on in a way that for a generation before just didn't get discussed very openly.
Yeah.
What impact did that have, do you think, that film, not only on you, but actually from people coming back to you saying, I saw that you were telling my story or my brother's story or what have you?
I don't know what impact it had on everybody because I can't speak for them.
Sure.
Just in relation to what Garvin was saying there, that whole notion of taking on fear.
Yes.
And not being afraid of it. That goes like socially, economically, from your home place, but also goes psychologically and where you're from and what you've been grown into and what the environment is and taking that on and not being afraid of trying to stand out because, you know, in school, part of the reason I became an actor afterwards was when I was in school, I was taught all the things and the environment was to do better, to be great, to be successful in your career, get straight A's. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure, but we were never taught about mental health. We were never taught about awareness. And that was something that I just had to question in myself, that if I'm going to continue... I was 18 years old then. I'm kind of risking my own mental health if I continue this way. So I wanted to become an actor to challenge myself and to ask questions. And mental health was one of those things where at the crux of it, it's not about that, who do you know in your family that has this or that whole shame-based mentality. It's we all know someone. Mm. We all experience it. And... it's about that everyday thing of taking care of ourselves and being able to talk to one another.
Yeah.
And that's the thing of just a communal thing of going, it's okay to talk.
Yeah, it was good. That's exactly it. Terry McMahon, wasn't that who
directed
that?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
That's good subject matter to bring up. And I also want to continue but then by asking about some of the other things that that struck me. Michael Inside was another challenging film about... It was so striking, the idea that certain parts of society can get caught up in a cycle and end up in prison... kind of by accident, almost, you know, that poor kid in that, and meeting unsavory people like yourself. I mean, of course, we are talking about you as an actor. But, you know, it was one of those films that brought an uncomfortable conversation that was necessary to have.
That's what I like about a lot of the Irish people that I've got to work with, say, Frank Berry. He comes from Killinarden, and he wanted to write from where he's from and give back to the community.
Yeah.
So he developed that script with ex-prisoners from the Pathways program. They developed it over 2 years. They told him the ins and outs of how things would work in the prison. And again, these are men who are trying to put on paper to help bring about and effect change for young people.
Yes.
Because again, it's a prison. If we're talking about mental health, that's a prison. If we're talking about actual prisons, if we're talking about homelessness, it's trying to write stories that create change, and that's what Frank did.
Yeah, and that's a really really good point about the prisons, and because Rosie, the Roddy Doyle script that you and Sarah Green, terrific, a desperately sad film. You're basically living out of a car for most of the film. Again, another prison of poverty.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, you're looking at that, and if mental health was the film with Patrick's Day, which we spoke about all those years ago, Rosie was the film of 2017,
yes.
16, a lot of people living in cars where they shouldn't be, or, you know, all that. Again, you're in that. So quite intense roles for you as you move along.
Yeah, but the common denominator there is mental health, is the shame of being homeless, the shame of being a prisoner, the shame of other people thinking you have an illness, and it's all connected.
Yeah.
And once we talk about it, once we bring it out there, you can hopefully affect change.
We love talking about history on this program, and Black 47. I was so thrilled to see the glad to see the famine on the big screen.
Yeah.
For starters, it wasn't the definitive famine movie because it was like a Sergio Leone movie.
Sure.
I mean, it's a brilliant western.
Yeah.
Set in 1847 of all things.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was a terrific film. There was something, brilliant about it.
Something visceral. I woke up one morning and I heard your voice on the radio. Mam told me, "Come out, Ryan's talking about Black 47. You gave it great support. And one of the things you touched on was that it was never done before, that period in history. And yeah, it was amazing to see even people from here, from the Gaeltacht area, people who came to see it not once, twice, three times, because it's one of the first Irish movies to use the Gaelic language, you know.
Cowil Maher.
Yeah.
Like that stuff was great.
Yeah,
but I'll just finish by saying that on that subject, that we have a Schindler's List style film based on the Irish famine waiting to happen. Somebody hasn't made it yet.
Oh, we
to show just the absolute horror of what happened to us as a people at that time. We haven't done it, and there's a whole generation, including our own in some ways, but certainly your kids and mine, who haven't quite got just what happened there. And it doesn't... It feeds... Excuse the use of the word, but it feeds somewhat into what's happening with Brexit and the UK and that country's distinct lack of understanding of who we are in many regards, particularly at the highest echelons.
Yes, indeed.
End of lecture. But I do think, I think they're connected.
Well, there'll be many attempts to make that film, you know.
I wish that somebody would do it.
It's going to be made, because Irish people like to see themselves represented truly on screen, you know.
And yeah.
There is certainly an anger about other people outside of Ireland just not understanding
what went on. It's certainly time. Yeah. Now, on a much lighter note, the action hero role that I don't know if you've dreamed of, but lots of people would have been waiting for, is that what you're filming at the moment?
I'm going to move to London at the end of the year to film this movie.
What's it called?
Can you tell? Knuckle Dust.
Knuckle Dust.
Yeah, of course
it is. What else would it be called? You know what I mean? And listen, if you want me to help you out in the gym, just call me. I'll point it out to you. It's just down there on the right.
I've got a good guy at the moment. I actually got a coach. I went back to train a little bit because I was doing this boxing film.
Yeah.
Again, set in a period when English rule was taken over Ireland 200 years ago. So I had to get in shape for that. It was written by the guys at Black 47, and this guy, Mark O'Regan, he's Mark Mind to Muscle Personal Fitness. He got me in shape, and we're working together to do this new action film.
In London, that's great.
Yeah.
And the other one you mentioned, who's in that with you, the boxing?
The boxing movie, it's directed by Brian Dernan. Pierce Ryan wrote it with Jamie Hannigan.
Great.
And it's a lot of pool together.
Look forward to that. And then we also have Dublin Murders, which we've been hearing about. So you're back again with Sarah Green.
Yes, indeed.
Killian Scott and Conleth Hill, Tom Vaughan Lawler.
Cast.
Great cast.
Should be out next month.
Yeah. After. Looking forward to that.
I've always wanted to play a cop too, you know.
Well, it's about time. It's about time. They're the Tana French novels, are they?
Yes.
That they're coming to life.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that'd be great. So again, were they filmed here in Ireland?
It's a BBC RTE co-production.
Yeah.
And it was filmed in Belfast. So I spent 7 months in Belfast, and about 10% was shot in Dublin.
It's a bit of everything.
Yeah.
So big move across to the UK then.
kind of this year I spent, you know, the guts of last year and the start of this year in Belfast, and I did my first job in London this year that Kerry Fox directed, and then I'm going to do this action movie then as well. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, you're just going one way, and that's ascending to the heights. And keep on going. Don't be a stranger. It's always great to see you, Mo. You're one of the gentlemen, and appreciate you coming in to see us.
Listen, thanks
today.
For coming out the wall.
Hey, listen, thanks for having us.
We're all delighted to have you
it's
here.
It's great to be here. Mo Dunford, everybody. What a pleasure. Thanks, Mo.
Thank you.
We'll take some photos and put them up on Instagram and Facebook and wherever else you care to find us. It's 8 minutes to 10 o'clock. We'll take a break with more after this. I want to say good morning to Joseph Duffy. Good morning, Joseph.
Hello, Ryan.
It's really nice to talk to you.
Nice to speak to you, Ryan, too.
Could you do me a favour and describe that extraordinary Victorian building that has been housing the Smithfield Fruit and Vegetable Market for so long? Describe it to me. What is it like?
It's a fabulous building. It was built by the British in the 1890s. They built them all over the world. It's a fabulous features on the brickwork and the steelwork. It's a lovely place to work in the summer. In the winter, it's Victorian, so it's very, very cold. It puts a lot of people off, but it's built like that, so it wouldn't heat up in the summer. So it's built to keep everything fresh before there was fridges and that.
Well, that makes sense, given what it's been housing for all these years.
Oh, yeah. It certainly fed the whole of Ireland at one time before, like, all the big central warehousing and supermarkets and all that. Everything came through the market here, all the fresh produce. Everything grown in Ireland came right through here. This was the hub.
Well, let's go back three generations to your grandfather and your grandmother.
Yes.
And tell me about their coming together.
Yes, my grandfather was one of the first auctioneers here in the market, Joseph Duffy also. Mm-hmm. And he worked as he was the director of Fletcher's. And my grandmother's family, the Bradys, they worked in the market as well. They had their own potato. They were potato merchants, seed merchants. And obviously my grandmother must have came in and she was maybe doing a wedding or flowers and she had bought at the auction. And my grandfather got to know her. He would pass the flowers down and maybe keep some flowers for her. And that's how the two families came together in the 1900s. So we've always had a Joseph Duffy in the market for the last 120 years.
And you'd be selling fruit and vegetables, but did you then just gravitate towards the flowers then ultimately?
Yeah, ultimately what happened, my father would have started in 57 in fruit, veg and flowers. I would have came in 1972-ish and I was 17 and I would have been driving all the fruit and veg from Rush and Old Town, bringing the big lorry loads of stuff into the market. And I went and trained with the Dutch people in flowers, because we used to sell a certain amount of flowers. And my brother Kevin was with me, and he would have sold the fruit and veg. But eventually, I went full time into flowers, and we just then ended up doing loads of weddings, funerals, all special occasions. So that's what happened.
And the market itself, it's closing when exactly?
It's closing on Friday. It's under renovation for the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
So they've done most of the work above ground. Underground is Victorian. Sewers and drains and catacombs, so there's a lot of work to be done underground. But it's going to be a great place for events. It's going to be a great place in the future as a big hub in the centre of the city with hotels going up and new university, Grange Gorman. So it's going to be a great spot. It's going to be like the Covent Garden of Dublin. It was built by the same people. And I was in the old Covent Garden when it closed, and then I was in the new market when it opened, Nine Elms in London.
Yeah.
My father took me over in the 70s, and he envisaged the new market would be built like this.
Well, that would be really special, because Covent Garden is so buzzy and so good for business, and it's a lovely place to go to. So there would have been a lot of families, Joseph, like your own, in the market there. And I presume great camaraderie and, you know, a huge amount of a sense of community about the place. What happens now to everyone there? Where are you all heading to?
It is sad over the years. Like, it was like a world of its own. People used to come down in the morning at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and it was buzzing around here. And in the old days, it was 50 different companies in the market itself, and it's down to 9 now at the moment, or 8. And all those families would have handed down generations, generations. So you would have known a lot of people. And it's sad over the years to see them either closing down or moving out or maybe the next generation, my own family would have came in, my own two children came in to do, you know, a little bit of work in the summertime maybe or whatever. And but I think it's the cold and that always gets people in the winter. Mm. You have to be very hardy. So we've lost a lot of the families over the years, yeah.
And where's your new place going to be then? For
well, our new place is going to be about 20 feet away from the top end of the market, which is Mary's Lane. And it's beside a nice Aran Cafe. And Lawler's, the fruit people, are on one side of us. And we have a fine new warehouse that we're getting ready this week to move into on Friday. So we're going to be just in the same area, which is great. And we'll have the same phones in a few weeks' time as well, same lines. So it's great for... I thought about retiring. I've done 45 years, which is a long time in the coal market. But loads of people ask me, you know, would I stay on? They'd miss us and, you know, they depend on us. And, you know, we have a good little business. You know, so hotels and restaurants and all people in the area were so easy to get to. And with the Lewis line now and, you know, we said we'd stay in the same area if we could. So
and will it look more like the English market in Cork or like the Covent Garden in London?
Well, I think it's be a bit of both according to the plans.
Okay.
It's so big, it's about six times the size of maybe Cork. It's nearly as big as Covent Garden, not quite as big because they have a few levels, but it'll be a fair size. There's a fair few acres in it. It's bigger than a lot of people think. It's only when you start to clear out you see all the space and that's in it. So, you know, it could be a really, really good spot, and I hope they do it justice. And I'm looking forward to it, you know. So a lot of memories, a lot of sadness, a lot of, you know. But I think if the right people do it, it'll be a fabulous place.
Good, I hope so. It sounds beautiful, potentially, architecturally and business-wise. It could be onto a winner there. So you'll still be selling flowers, Joseph, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. We'll be still selling our flowers, yeah. We do weddings, we do funeral work, we'll do wholesale. We do all sorts of events. We supply event companies. So thank God we're kept busy.
Yeah,
for promotions.
A text says, my mother and her sister always brought their flowers and wedding flowers at that market. Their names are Maureen Quinn, and Alice Coffey. Do you remember them?
I do very well, very well.
Lovely
family, the two sisters, yes.
I remember. There you are.
Yeah, oh, great, yeah.
Because my own mother used to go down to the market to buy flowers of a morning too, because she just loved the buzz of it and getting up early and going down. So you could go down and not buy wholesale, you could just go down
and probably just
kind of like spoof your way into a bouquet of flowers or something from somebody like yourself. And
everything is sold by the wrap, or we do bouquets as well for people.
Great.
We look after customers.
How do you feel about lilies, Joseph?
Lilies, yeah, there's all different types of lilies nowadays. It's not just the one type. So, like, we have ones that wouldn't have stamens in them now. There's a new double lily out.
What's the one that wrecks your clothes when you brush off them?
Yes, most of the lilies have this little powder that comes out of the lily. But there's new lilies that haven't got that stamen.
Good.
So they're always bringing out something new with perfume or with no perfume. You know?
It's all evolving. I presume flowers are nearly evolving the way dogs that you see, some that are being kind of like eugenics for flowers, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, crossbreeds.
Crossbreed flowers.
Oh, yeah.
Is that happening a lot too?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bring out new colours, new varieties. Flowers that weren't out 20 years ago are actually saleable now, and they have their long life. Like things like clematis, people can't believe you can buy clematis as a cut flower. Lots of new flowers, I'd call them. Years ago, it was your chrysanthemums, carnations, and roses, maybe.
Yeah.
But there's probably 500 different types of flowers now that you can buy.
It's beautiful. I like the country garden sort of mix of flowers in it. You know, that sort of old. You know what you like, don't you, when you go to buy flowers? You want
your
style. You like.
The fashion now, like for weddings, the girls call them wild flowers, but they're not really wild, but it gives that appearance.
Yeah.
They've been pulled out of your granny's garden.
But they haven't at all. You've been curating them carefully in a lab somewhere, have you?
Well, we've been sourcing them in 17 different countries get them into Ireland.
No granny's gardens were harmed in the making of this bouquet, right?
Oh, that's exactly.
Hey, listen, good luck to you and the family, Joseph. I know you're still going, so it's
great,
on it goes. It's real nice to talk to you today, and I hope the move is successful and fruitful.
Oh, thanks very much, Ryan. Thank you very
Not
much.
Not at all. All the best.
Good luck.
Nice to talk to you. Joseph Duffy joining us. Fruitful was, just a fortuitous gaffe. At 9:30 on the button, 51551, Alex Bartley, crime writer. Good morning.
Good morning,
and
Ryan.
Welcome along.
Thank you.
Now, we spent a little time in Skull on Monday morning and Sunday evening. We did the radio show from there. So we feel that this week almost has a sort of West Corky feel to it. Tell us about where you live. Tell us a little bit about the physicality, the geography of it, and I'll ask the next question after that.
Okay.
So let's begin. No, I think it's important to put you in a place here, because your new book is all about that.
Yeah, I live in the Bear Peninsula, just outside Irie's Village, which is absolutely beautiful, picturesque, beautiful coloured houses. It's like something out of a children's TV show. It's adorable. And then you've got the Bear Peninsula, which is magnificent. And it's one of those places that if people haven't been there, even the photos don't do it justice. It's incredible, rugged, beautiful coastal areas, little beaches and gorgeous people. It's a really warm place with a landscape that's quite rugged all the same. So it's just an absolute joy to live in and then to set a really nasty book in.
And perfect. And we'll get to the nasty book in a moment. But you would have been a Dublin born and bred,
yeah,
right? And if you were to drive on a regular day from Dublin to the Bear Peninsula, you'd be in the car for how long, roughly?
Almost 5 hours.
Great. Now, why the trek so far for you as a city woman heading down to the village on the edge of the world?
It was the idea of getting away and writing in a really inspirational place. And I had first gone to Annam Cara Writers Retreat and fell in love with the entire area.
That's around there somewhere.
It's about like 2 minutes from my house. It's absolutely gorgeous and it's in a particularly beautiful setting as well. So when I went down there, I just went, oh my God, this is amazing. And I moved down not knowing how long I would stay there for, and 12 years later.
It's funny because it's the same as with Skull, is that these villages and towns in West Cork, particularly, more than any others that we visit for the purpose of the show or whatever, seems to attract a lot of artists and foodie people, be they from Germany or England or Dublin. What is the attraction, I wonder?
I think there's some magic in the air. You know, I think you just see it all the time. I know lots of writers who have moved down there, and you just go, you're away from it all. You're inspired by what's around. I really do think there's a type of magic in the air that I can't explain. You can write all kinds of places and you get a feel for the energy of the place, and that's what that's got. And, you know, great food producers and everything. So there's that whole area that people are really open to all of that as well. They're cultural, they're open to the food thing as well.
So that brings all sorts.
You hear every accent under the sun, you know. It's really interesting with the lovely Irish mix then as well.
Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, when they develop it into the local vernacular. Do small towns in Ireland, are they inclined to attract more gossip than a city?
I don't know. I find it interesting that everybody knows everybody's business. It is unavoidable.
Yeah. And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I found it a bit of an adjustment at the start.
I'd find that very claustrophobic.
I would have thought that as well. Actually, what I realised was you have people looking out for you, and that was worth its weight in gold. And I really mean that, because I know you're thinking,
interpretation.
No,
everyone knows everyone's business because they're keeping an eye on you, for you.
No, but it is quite funny that people notice things and you're thinking that cannot fly under the radar. But no, in a way, then it's looking out for you, and things like you left your, you know, car window open and it's raining. Things like that.
Whose car is that?
That's disaster.
Yeah. But in the sense that you can look at it two ways. You can look at it, it's small, it's community, and it is minding each other. And then there's the smallest community, and it's just a little bit saying, oh, look, Mary got a new curtains, you know.
Well, I think what's lovely about that, right, is that you have that sense of people know everything pretty much about what's going on with everyone else.
Yeah.
But it also creates this thing, because they're living there in that area, in a small town, that everyone just gets on with it. I don't find it judgy at all, because, you know, in small towns, people are living there, they've grown up there, you know, all their lives in some cases. So, you know, there's a lot of forgiveness, I would say, as well, and understanding. So,
one of your favourite books down through the years was Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Yes.
Which is, just a humdinger, isn't it?
I mean, spectacular. Okay. One of those books that you go, why didn't I read that years ago?
Yeah, and it's actually a great movie too. But the reason I mentioned Rebecca of all the books, because you'd have To Kill a Mockingbird and all great classics. Yeah. But the reason I mentioned Rebecca particularly, because from your new book, I confess, I definitely got a sense of that by the sea. Mystery, it's windswept, you can almost lick your lips and taste salt water, you know, it's that sort of
Well,
vibe.
That's a wonderful compliment.
Is that the world you kind of, it's kind of almost modern Gothic?
Yeah, exactly, perfectly described. And just that idea that being standing out on a cliff edge, the sea churning, stormy weather, I love that. And it's really, really inspirational, because people would often say, how can you be down there in the winter, it must be bleak. And I'm thinking, no, it is absolutely magnificent. Sea looks different.
Yeah.
You know, there is that Gothic feel, and then setting it in a, you know, Gothic former convent, that just creates more than claustrophobia alongside the open sea. So yes. I like the dichotomy there.
All the characters, sorry, just do you want to give us the pitch, the 1 minute pitch?
Every author's least favorite question.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the
do
synopsis.
You want me to do it?
No, no. Yeah, okay, go for it.
Okay,
yeah,
so
you'll do a better job.
Well, I've got about 10 pages left, which is great, because I don't quite know what happened. So it's a bunch of pals who were all grew up in the 80s, pretty much my age now, which allowed me to connect with it very much. And they're all from this particular part of the world in Cork. And two of them have bought this enormous inn, Jamaica Inn. And they're all gathered around for some class of reunion type thing. But they all have desperately private stories behind. And there's skullduggery in extremis. And lots of mess, and it's just a page-turning thriller.
That's beautifully done, and I will rip that off the next time I'm asked to pitch. It's so hard to sum it up.
It is hard. I just hate your pain when I ask you that. You said everyone hates that question.
So that and the synopsis are the hardest things. You know, they really are.
But by the way, there's lots of humour in this, which I thought was lovely too.
You
pun up, which is good. kudos to you for that. I particularly liked Ludo.
Oh,
for
yes.
For the Cluedo game. But that's for people who get into it. They'll appreciate it more and more. You went for it feels, again, if you talk about Du Maurier, you've got the Agatha Christie thing versus they're all in the house and Ludo versus Cluedo. Tell me about that idea and in terms of where you're going with.
Yeah, it's that setup where you've got a group. So it is that classic setup where there's a house and it's this tight environment and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm. And then you're wondering, OK, who did this? And what I loved about that is being able to weave in flashbacks. So instead of giving you who everybody is right now, there's that sense of you come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
So when it all gets really nasty, you're able to guess, okay, who do you think? So it's that classic setup, but with a kind of modern twist as well. And it's really, really enjoyable to write and very different from what I've written before.
Yeah, because you're so American in the previous books you've written. I mean, you've done Irish before, but it's just a run of Americana, if you like. And now you're right back in the heart of Ireland. Totally different pen in your hand, I suppose.
It was really different. And especially with dialogue, I write a lot of dialogue and I love it. And I write into the characters that way. So it was really unusual, though, writing Irish dialogue when I'm so used to American, because you're also trying to not make it sound too twee as well, which it can look like on paper. When people are speaking.
You nailed it. There's no issue there.
Thank you so much.
So I asked this question of Joe Spain and to Patricia Gibney and Liz Newton, and I'll ask you, how can such lovely human beings be so full of such vile, cruel, nasty, vicious, sadistic...
keep going.
This is all for the back of the book now, for the next print. Where do you go for that? Is there any real life on that, or do you just watch way too much? Yeah, how's the therapy going? Or is there just is it just simply from life experience, or
well,
what
that's
you
alarming.
Read or watch?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I think we all have a capability for darkness, and I think we can have dark thoughts. They're the ones you don't say out loud.
But you can write them.
But you can write them,
in
which
a novel.
Is marvellous. And you know, somebody asked me recently, is it difficult to write a killer? And I'm saying it is effortless, which is, you know, slightly worrying as well.
How is it effortless to write a killer?
Their voices are the loudest, which sounds completely mad, but the killers come in for me as, you know, it's like channeling somebody, which is quite disturbing. Yeah. And I just write, and it is beyond my control. It's, to a degree, feels like that way with all the characters.
Like you're possessed.
But yeah, maybe. I'd be very afraid.
But
small
it's,
studio.
In all the, like, I was only thinking more recently in whatever book you read, the killer, the baddie, the bad person in these things, they're always the most kind of entertaining. You find yourself drawn to. If you just take a typical example of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, the movie, for example, whatever. You're waiting for him to come on.
I know.
Why they are we into that? So that's a bit sick too, isn't it?
I know. And they are really entertaining because I have a killer that appears in another book and he's absolutely one of my favourite characters to write.
Yes.
And the Hannibal Lecter thing, it's, yeah, on the screen you are alive watching this. But I remember thinking that from fairy tales when I was a child.
Even
it was
back.
Like, yeah, forget about those people. Where's the big bad wolf?
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I'm interested in, this looming presence. And, you know, I think by their very nature they have this charisma that you don't want to be drawn to. I mean, if you met them in real life, there's absolutely no way you would be as drawn to them. I'd say it would be quite chilling. But when you're writing about it, it's just magnetic.
But don't they say that, like, the captains of industries are psychopaths and that, you know, you don't have to have a ski mask and a trolley to be wheeled around. You could just be your
trolley.
Boss.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, there are those tendencies and they're across the board. And I think as well with any kind of thing like that, it's a bit of a pick and mix. You know, some tendencies will be there and others won't. But you can see that to achieve a certain height of success, if you have an absence of, you know, emotion on your way up there, it might be easier to, you know,
to succeed in whatever it is you want to do.
Leave a trail of destruction behind you.
That's unnerving. In 2013, you released, I just wonder about your young adult writing for a moment, because it's I don't know, when I was growing up, there wasn't much of it.
I know.
Now it's a thing, and rightly so. So you've another one coming out with, can you remember the title of this?
I know.
I mean, it's coming out in March, I think, next year. What's the title?
It's called My Heart and Other Breakables. And you can read the title.
No, wait, finish it.
How I Lost My Mom, Found My Dad, and Made Friends with Catastrophe.
It's delicious.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And this is a diary form novel, which is great because that's what younger people just need to get into reading. I think a diary thing would be a good start. Yeah.
It was great because it was short, snappy entries. Then you could also go a little bit longer. And it features a 15-year-old girl who's lost her mom and doesn't know who her father is. So goes on this sleuthing expedition for that. Yeah. And it's comedy, but very poignant, obviously, because it features grief. So that was an absolute joy to write. It was a totally different type of experience because of the humour. But it was interesting because obviously, as you said, there's humour in I Confess. But it got really humorous to the point that I had to pare it back because I was writing My Heart and Other Breakables. So it was lovely writing the diary form, lovely being in the head of a teenage girl.
Yes.
I could have kept writing it forever because, you know, it's a diary. Well, and
there may be more. Because even the young children reading Diary of a Wimpy Kid and all these kind of, like, it's great for them to be starting so young, and it's easy. It's a text from Liz Nugent.
Oh, I love
Liz Nugent.
She's
glued to you on the programme this morning. Talking about a brilliant new novel, I Confess. Thank you, Liz.
Oh, thank you, Liz.
It's great to see that there's a sort of, you know, a sorority and sort of.
It is incredible. I mean, I just think the support is epic, and you do need it so much, even just from the fact that you're on your own for most of the time doing your thing. And there's just massive support, and crime writers are just a fantastic bunch of very funny messers.
They are. Exactly. And anytime I meet them and you know, on or off air, they're always good for a scoop and a chat. You know what I mean?
Brilliant.
Like, it's great.
Absolutely.
I'm a big fan. And not so earnest, you know. You know what I mean?
I know, you can't be.
Lovely interview with Alex Barkley, says the text. Off out to buy I Confess. We spend our summer holidays every year on the Berra Peninsula in Ardgroom.
Oh, lovely.
Which is near
that's
where you are.
Down the road.
Yeah, down the road. Can't wait to read the book and be transported back to Berra. Yay for Alex Barkley, who's absolutely great, says the text. And Lee was on to say, Alex's books have always transported me into a world of mystery and suspense with a perfect balance of darkness, humour and dark humour, which we love. Very familiar with the Berra Peninsula. I'm looking forward to comparing the haunting imagery in the book to the rugged landscape and surroundings. I had read a heap of books that were fairly serious and chin-strokey. And then I saw yours came in. I went, great, this is what I want. Like a really cracking thriller, which is exactly what it is.
Thank you.
So congratulations on it. And is this where you're going to keep going now with Irish...
I don't know. Because the next one is standalone as well. And it's sort of like, what am I going to do? Yeah. And I'm lucky that I get the freedom. I have a fantastic editor and there's the freedom there to come and alarm them with whatever new idea.
But your head is always fizzing, isn't it, with ideas?
Yes, it does not stop.
It does not stop.
Like
mine. So do you have to go back to your cave now in Dara and light some candles and get busy thinking about the next plot? Is that the plan?
My gothic mansion.
Your gothic mansion. Because you're in the city now and it feels like you've emerged.
Yes. Blinking
into the light. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really strange. So I've got another 48 hours and have my launch tonight. Yeah, and it's lovely because it's this buzz and then I'll be back there hiding away again. Yeah. You know, I love it both because I couldn't do this all the time. The city's too exciting. You get drawn out.
Too loud. Yeah. You get nothing done.
Nothing done.
Alex Barty, congratulations on I Confess. I loved it. I'm thrilled for you.
Thank you.
I look forward to the next one already, which is a great compliment to give, if I may.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for coming in to see us this morning. Safe journeys back to the cave at 9:45. But I want to welcome to the studio Ardal O'Hanlon. Good morning, Ardal. It's nice
Good
to talk.
Good morning, Ryan.
It's been a while since I saw you, actually, but thank you for coming in to see us this morning.
It's lovely. Lovely to be here.
We've much to discuss, largely because you've been kind of road testing, it seems like, a comedy tour. Is that right? You cast a fly. Is that it to see what's going on?
Yeah. I did a leg of this tour in the spring in the UK, mostly. So I was parked there for a while. Trolling our British neighbours, essentially.
Is that what you were doing?
Well, there's a touch of that, you know. I mean, I try to avoid like hard politics in my show. Like, I'm very politically engaged in some ways. You know, I'm interested in politics, but I try to avoid it in my show because, you know, I've misgivings about comedians like wearing their politics or their ideology on their sleeve. You know, I think your primary role as a comedian is to poke fun at everybody and everything. And, you know, to stand back like a corner boy in the old days, you know, sneering at everyone. So, you know, I find comedians who are a little bit too ideological, you know, just a bit po-faced.
Yes. Yeah. And a little earnest and with that quite dull. Yeah. And
but having said that, you have to touch on things like Brexit when you're there, you know, and you have to find a way of doing it. Like, I play to a very mixed audience when I'm over there. You know, I don't play it like, you know, I'm not playing to the gallery, you know, to my sort of liberal constituency, you know. Yeah. I'm playing to a very mixed crowd. A lot of older people, sometimes younger people, certainly a lot of Brexiteers, you know, I'm playing, you know, it's half and half. So you have to find a way of navigating all that.
That's intriguing because the vote was, 52-48 in the referendum for Brexit. And conversations in America, I mean, I'm talking about like a polite conversation, whether it's in a coffee shop or at dinner with friends. You don't know who you're talking to now because the privacy of the ballot box is just that.
Yeah.
So you have to, as a comedian in your audience, you don't know who. Where.
It's like, it's in America, you know, it is like, you know, Americans, as we know, are the most friendly, polite, hospitable people in the world until you start talking to them.
More recently, yes.
Yeah, and it's so divided and so dysfunctional.
Yes. But does that fall on both sides in terms of, you know, the political discourse has got quite dark. If you think about the Trump rallies and, you know, his attitude, say, to the press and so forth. And this isn't, I'm not trying to basket of deplorable this conversation about the Trump supporters. There's nothing to do with that. That's not it. Really, it's more just about the tenor of debate.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Trump, like one of his great achievements, and he's achieved an awful lot, as he'll tell you every day, one of his best achievements is absolutely coarsening political debate. And driving it right down into the gutter. You know, it's the complete lack of civility now in politics. It's the shameless, barefaced lying. I love that Washington Post project.
Yeah.
Where they count the lies, you know, and they call them out for what they are. They're lies, verifiable lies. I think it's over 10,000 now, you know. And like, I used to do a joke in my show. I couldn't be bothered doing it anymore. It's about, like, Trump is such a big liar, like the biggest liar in the world. If he came out tomorrow and admitted he was a lying, racist, misogynist, I don't think I'd believe him, you know. And that's where my head's at most days.
And that's kind of crisscrossed across the Atlantic and over the Irish Sea and into 10 Downing Street. And as per the Channel 4 boss there, we played her earlier on, saying it's no longer acceptable to kind of make excuses for or to offer a nuance to a misspeaking and just call it for what it is.
There is no justification for Boris Johnson. I mean, did you see him on the news last night? Yeah. He just looked like the naughty schoolboy who had forgotten to do his homework, and he's just winging it. I remember a brilliant line by Guardian journalist Marina Hyde, who's, you know, frequently hilarious about all these things. And she described him as like a rubbish bag opened by a fox. And that's what I think about every time I see him. That's who he is.
But is he not beloved of a massive section of the British public? I mean, you're not a British citizen. I'm not a British citizen. Who are we to say other than as couch bound observers of the news? You know, and what business is it of ours? But that's one question. And the second thing is, you know, there are people who think he's the bee's knees and he's
a
wonderful...
Yeah, I mean, he's a good raconteur. He's a character. He's a gas man. But, you know, like, I think, you know, you'd prefer to have serious people, you know, running countries.
Well, that's a very old-fashioned trope now.
I'm an old-fashioned guy.
But listen to Brazil. The guy's saying that the NGOs, the president, set the fires.
Yeah.
It's like Alice in Wonderland.
But it's the disregard. It's like, who cares about the fires? You know, it's a very strange world we live in. I mean, I think the big problem is, you know, we all take it too seriously and too personally ourselves in some senses. You know, like, I don't know about you, but I wake up in the morning, first thing I do would be, you know, grab my phone or stick on Morning Ireland. And, you know, so for the first hour of your day, you're listening to the latest Trump outburst or the latest Brexit nonsense or the crazy man in Brazil and the fires.
Yeah.
This is before you've spoken a civil word to anyone else, before you've hugged anyone, before you've listened to Kate Bush, before you've had your toast, before you've stroked the dog, you know.
Yeah.
And you're starting every day appalled and outraged.
Yeah, no
and
wonder,
it's not healthy,
no,
Ryan.
It's not healthy.
And you're talking about it now. We could be talking about anything
but pleasant,
you know.
But it's just, I think it's just all, it's so consuming. Even if you watch kids watching the news, they're kind of freaked out.
Yeah.
You know, going, well, I don't know if I want, why is the fire, is the world ending? Why are there two yellow-haired men running the world? I don't understand.
People are,
you know, free.
There's a malaise.
And yet, having said that, this is two people probably of a similar hue chatting to each other, and then there'll be people who'll be listening in going, you guys are so wrong. You've got it so wrong, you know, that actually Trump is speaking for an enormous amount of people, that the Boris Johnson is speaking an awful lot of sense. You know, that's back to the divisions
about. Well, I agree with you. And I kind of pine for... you know, the middle ground. I miss it. I miss nuance. I miss, you know, people having moderate opinions. That was always great. But and now, you know, you are forced to choose. You're forced to pick your tribe. Like, you know, there is they used to talk about the culture wars, and you know, that was kind of vague, like, you know, the culture wars. But now it's a real thing. We had it in Ireland during the various referendums to some extent. Britain had it with Brexit. America had it with Trump. You know, where suddenly now there is this deep division. And you look at, like, say Britain, you know, where I spend a fair bit of time. You've got propaganda organs like The Guardian and The Telegraph.
Yeah.
They're no longer objective newspapers.
Yeah, they're Fox and CNN. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. And you sort of have to pick, you know. So, you know, I lean towards The Guardian because, you know, I see myself as a vaguely wishy-washy liberal type person. But, you know, I can't read it anymore. Like, it's extreme. Yeah,
yeah,
but it's almost a parody of itself. And likewise, The Telegraph on the other side is just ridiculous, you know, just, you know, promoting these opposing ideologies.
Yeah.
And you know, you kind of just miss, like, you know, where's objectivity? You know, where's...
Well, you know, I think that unless that's a rhetorical question, in which case I'll shut up. But otherwise, I think that you have to look closer to home. I think we in this country are doing rather well.
Yeah.
It's
fantastic to be on the high moral ground, isn't it?
It's took us years. But, you know, when you think of, you know, even the leadership politically on all sides, it seems to be quite mature and constructive. And, you know, even the fact that Taoiseach is a gay man who is, in, you know, 40 years old and, you know, represents us well abroad and home. You know, there's a lot to be taken from how we are doing in the face of all the crazy next door.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Yeah. And, you know, we are holding the middle ground. We seem to be one of the few societies who are managing to do that.
Yeah.
And there's no shame in that.
No.
But people want drama in their lives. Like, this is the thing.
Well, they got it.
Yeah. Well, just get a smoke machine for your house and, you know, just give it a few blasts in the morning and put on some Beethoven and that'll give you all the drama you need.
Yeah, that's why God created Lyric FM, I think, just to calm us all down. Your father was, he was a politician. He was a minister. And he was, you know, he was a teetotaler, unusually enough, I suppose, for his time. What do you?
I made up for that.
Well, you made up for that as a youngster. How do you reflect on him now, just politically, and what he left you legacy wise?
I don't know. I mean, I always admired him. I admired his work ethic was the big thing when I was growing up. I couldn't understand it, why someone would want to pound the pavements like hour after hour, day after day, week in, week out, year in, year out. I mean, he was an incredibly hardworking rural Irish politician, you know, who left no stone unturned, wanted to help people, loved his country more than anything else, still does, you know. So he's an absolute patriot to the core of his being, in the best possible sense of the word, I think. And, you know, worked very hard. In terms of, like, the politics, as I grew older, like, when I was a kid, like, when he got elected first, it was just very exciting. You know, elections were really exciting in those days.
Posters and leaflets and ballot papers and pencils.
Yeah, you know, it was the back of trucks in the town, and there was crowds used to come to listen to politicians speaking on the back of trucks things and after mass and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there was a tremendous excitement, and, you know, that your father was involved in this was a cool thing, I suppose. But then as I went to college and my head was turned... And, you know, you get involved in politics and you end up sort of signing, you know, those kind of things like...
Funny enough, the words escaped me too. Yeah. But he was obviously Fianna Fáil, I should stress that as well. When you said your head was turned, was that politically?
Yeah, or? Kind of politically, I suppose, like particularly on the social issues of the day. So you had divorce referendums, you had
abortion
referendums
in the 80s,
and all those kind of things. And, you know... You know, I just, you know, sort of diverged, I suppose, fairly, you know, radically, in terms of political views from my father. You know,
did that cause a problem?
Well, I mean, my family are very conservative people. I mean, they're lovely people, and I get on well with them. I'm glad to say that we're able to do that. You know, despite the very heated debates over the last couple of years, so we're still very, very civil to each other, and we kind of sometimes sidestep some of those bigger issues when we meet. But I did. I went to England. I scarpered fairly soon after I started comedy. Well, because it was uncomfortable for him, it was uncomfortable for me. It would have been very uncomfortable for a government minister at the time to have a son who was a stand-up comedian, like shooting his mouth off and just being really incredibly stupid about a lot of things. And then it would have been really awkward for me trying to have credibility as a comedian living in somewhere like in a small society like Dublin, you know, where people would pick up on that and maybe make sport out of it, you know. And anyway, you know, there was no comedy scene in Ireland. So like, you know, I was always going to go to London to try and, you know, find my way as a comedian.
Yes.
But it was a relief to get away. Do you know what I mean? And not to have that constant association
with the politician father and the comedian.
And it's not that I'm anti Fianna Fáil or anything like that. You know, certainly not. You know, I you know, they always kind of steered a kind of a middle course, you know, in the Bertie Ahern's three terms as Taoiseach, you know, like up to the last couple of years.
Up to the cliff edge fall.
All seemed
there
to work okay.
Yeah.
You know, not for everyone, of course, but, you know.
And when you talk about the conservative family then, when you were a child, were you a show-off? I mean...
Well,
and how did that
not
work
really? I call my show "The Showing Off Must Go On."
That's what I'm wondering.
Like, well, you see, my family were very, like, as I said, hardworking people, but also head down people. You know, you don't stick your head above the parapet.
Don't be noticed
at all. I come from Carrick and Cross. People don't wear high vis jackets in Carrick and Cross in case people think they're showing off. Look at them there, holding the stop go sign, the big show off. Wants everyone to look at them. You know, I actually literally remember one time my mother made spaghetti bolognese for the family, and she told us, "Don't tell anyone," in case the neighbours thought we were showing off. You know, they hear the Hanlons have gone all Italian. You know, next they'll be throwing tomatoes at each other and showing affection in public. You know, and painting frescoes on the ceilings of churches. So that was the kind of...
So it was like head down.
Head down, but don't show off. You get new clothes, don't wear them.
They're probably still in the drawer at home.
They're still there at home. I go and look at them from time to time. But like, you know, so it was that kind of family. Like it was...
But your Auntie Maura.
Yeah.
Your Aunt Maura.
Oh yes, I had an Aunt Maura.
Did she not come to you and say, "Tell us another story," or make me laugh? For
oh yeah,
was she sort of a catalyst for a bit of this?
I mean, I was a quite shy kid, but I suppose not in the context of the big family that I came from. There were six of us, and I suppose maybe I was the show off in the context of the family.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
In
the house,
and, of course.
You know, I do remember my Aunt Maura coming and she seemed to always enjoy my stories and my made up stories, like my about my imaginary friend.
Did they have a name, or was that just a random your imaginary
Eamon.
Friend?
Eamon was his name.
Straight off the tongue.
You have no idea when I heard that Eamon wasn't real, like how devastated I was.
Who told you?
My brother, Frank.
Did he exist?
No.
It's getting a bit surreal. But it was a difficult time for you, obviously.
It was a difficult time. But then, you know, I finally found an outlet for my stories.
You did. You found the stage.
Yeah.
Your grandfather was Michael O'Hanlon. His association with Michael Collins, because we started our show on Monday in Skull talking to Michael Collins' great-grandniece.
Oh, wow.
We end our week talking to Ardal O'Hanlon about, among other things, your grandfather, Michael O'Hanlon.
Yeah.
And his connection with Collins.
He was an extraordinary man. I didn't really know him well, but he was one of the hand-picked men that Michael Collins sent out after Bloody Sunday. And my history is terrible, memories. Yeah. 1919?
It would have been, we'll go on anyway.
Michael Collins had this mission, which was featured in the movie Michael Collins as well, of course, and in all good history books, the rebels at the time were tasked with taking out British intelligence in Ireland. So there was 12 three-man hit squads sent around various parts of Dublin. And he was part of that. He was part of that outfit. You know, he was just 18 at the time. He was a medical student in UCD. But he was a very committed rebel, fought in the War of Independence, was sentenced to death, by General Mulcahy, as so many of the people who fell on the wrong side of the Civil War. This is slightly later after the Civil War.
Yes,
that death sentence was later commuted. He had an amazing life, but he was a very quiet man. Never spoke about it. I shouldn't be talking about it now. Probably.
Well, no, I suppose it's intriguing that he would have been led by Collins and then his son, your father, became a Fianna Fáil minister, which would have been very much Dev and anti-treaty.
Yeah.
I wonder what got lost in translation or found in translation along the way there.
Yeah.
But and then we get into the Irish independence and finding our feet quite well. And all roads then bring us to kind of Brexit in a way, and how they seem to be falling apart at the seams, and their parliament is a mess.
Yeah,
leadership.
Well, they seem to be
messy.
Going through an identity crisis.
Don't
you
they?
Like in the early part of the 20th century, Ireland went through a massive identity crisis. We reinvented ourselves. We created an identity in a sense with our new sports and our, you know, our music and our dancing and our costumes and reviving the Irish language and all these things. You know, we're a big part of an identity creating exercise, and I think the British or the English, I suppose, really to be more precise about it, are going through a similar identity crisis at the moment.
Yeah, and it happens. It's cyclical, isn't it?
It's cyclical, and it's convulsive, and it's going to have massive ramifications. And by the way, they're fully entitled to.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's just the way they're handling it is shocking.
Yeah,
and they seem to, like, at every step, you know, make the worst possible decision. Putting Boris Johnson in there is a good example of that.
Yes, and Jeremy Corbyn's another day's work.
What we want to happen is, to be positive, just for the sake of it, is, you know, we want a general election. We'd love to see a Labour-Lib Dem coalition without Jeremy Corbyn at the helm, and then have another referendum.
This is the Gargenista dream, is it?
Yeah, this is the dream.
Okay. And you're living in the UK now, right?
No, I live in Dublin.
Oh, did you? I thought you were over there.
No. I did the first half of the tour over there, and then I was away for the summer filming this other thing, and then I'm back now to do the second half of the tour, which includes a big Irish leg.
Oh, wonderful. So Death in Paradise is... if you look at the big TV moments with Father Ted and Death in Paradise, obviously completely different things. How do you reflect on the two shows now?
Well, they're both set on islands.
That's a good start. But they brought very different things to your world.
Yeah, definitely very different things. And that's the beauty of this career in one way. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty in a career like mine. And, you know, you go through ups and downs and good times, bad times. But Death in Paradise, it was one of those weird jobs that came out of nowhere about 4 years ago. I've spent the last four summers in this island called Guadeloupe in the middle of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing, but it's hard work, and, you know, it's an interesting job. It's a good job, I've got a lot out of it.
But your kids are of an age now where they don't, you don't have to rush back to bottle feed them now. They're out the other side.
No,
different type of bottle, maybe.
It was actually a show that they really liked at the time, so it was a very easy decision to make, you know.
So that's good. How old are your...
They're 22, 20 and 17.
They're grand. Yeah. They're grand. And when you look at, I mean, I just want to mention briefly your brief role in Derry Girls, which was one of those great comic successes of recent times. Yeah. When you watched the first few episodes of it, did you think they're onto something? Did you get it immediately?
Yeah. I knew the writer Lisa McGee anyway, because I'd done her previous show on Channel 4 called London Irish, which wasn't a success in any way, but you know, Channel 4 stuck with her.
And try again.
Gave her a second go, and she got the tone absolutely bang on with Derry Girls. It's beautiful, fun. What I love about it is it's just, you know, it crosses all the generations. They're all represented. You know, it's women characters. But, it just works so well.
It's a win. Yeah. Let's get some texts in with Ardal O'Hanlon this morning. Please ask Ardal to tell the story of the time he got a taxi home from Dublin Airport regarding his car parked there from Paula in Dartry.
Oh, God.
Well, what happened?
Well, it's true. Obviously I've struggled to escape, you know, the Dougal character over the years, and a couple of years ago, I remember I was in this taxi and I arrived at Dublin Airport and I asked the taxi driver to take me home. Like, I gave him the address. I didn't just assume he knew where I lived or anything. And he just wanted to talk about Father Ted, and he was kind of looking at me with pity. Like, people think I'm genuinely very stupid, you know. And he actually asked me at one point, he said, do you remember being in it? Like, sort of. Yeah. And so I'm trying to change the subject to sport, politics or whatever. And I'm using big words to try and impress him. And
this is your life, basically.
This is my life. Yes, this is my life. And then I suddenly remember, I was about 20 minutes into the journey home. And I did remember that I have a car and that I parked it at the airport 3 days previously. And, you know, I was tired and I couldn't tell him.
You couldn't tell.
I literally, you know, because I know how the world works, you know, one little slip up, you never be allowed to forget.
That's
and
for sure.
You never believe in your car. So I actually let him take me home as soon as I was at home.
For the shame.
I called another taxi and I went back to the airport. So a true story.
It's a great one. Tom says, ask Ardal, did he enjoy Death in Paradise, which you've answered, which is great. Ardal is a pure tonic, great start to the working day. Well, that's better than being bamboozled by Brexit. I worked in the summer of 1989 with Ardal at the check-in in Aer Lingus.
Oh my God.
He had us all laughing all summer and would barely scrape together the parts of the uniform and was sitting at a desk one day with one epaulette and a different coloured tie than the official black one. Say hi from Jerry Kennedy. So that's a nice memory from your desk days.
Very good. There was a little scene in Father Ted once about, you know, about very, 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 very black. So, you know, that came from my time at the airport because you had to wear very, 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 very black socks. And my socks were just dark blue. And I got in trouble. I was actually not allowed work at the check-in that desk day because my socks were just very, very, very dark
blue. Zero tolerance, if ever I heard. Last one from Tom, our friend Tom in Rosslare, who says, tell Ardal, as a PC repairman who looked after TD's PCs in the 90s, I could tell his father was really proud of him because every time I powered up his dad's PC, it always had a great photo of Ardal on the desktop.
Oh.
Did you know that?
God, the rest of the family wouldn't be too happy about that.
I know. No. Maybe it was a family photo.
Yeah,
I need
I'm
to
sure
remember
it was.
Ardal's
My father's always been very fair.
Very
and even
equitable. Okay. There's a whole other story there we'll get to another day. But in the meantime, you're in Vicar Street in Dublin. Great venue on the 9th of November. And then 20 days later, you're up to Limerick's University Concert Hall.
That's right.
And on the following day, then 30th of November, on Belfast Waterfront.
Yes.
Great to have you back on the touring circuit.
Yes.
And thanks
for
coming.
Cork and Galway as well, I think, in there
great.
Somewhere.
You're covering the whole island.
Oh, God.
It's always great.
Leave the Cork people
out. No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't want to darken a door there again after that. Ardal O'Hanlon, what a pleasure to see you, as always.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for your time this morning.
Cheers.
It's 10 to 10.